Welcome to Geopolitical Horizons, the podcast from thegeopolicy.com. This week we're going to do something different. We're going to go through a number of questions you guys sent in to us. We asked on a number of different platforms for your questions, and today's going to be that day where we answer all these for you. So thank you for those that sent us the questions, which we've categorized and we put them in some sort of order, and we're going to send them over to Adnan Khan, who's here with us today. How are you keeping, Adnan? Are you ready for today?
I'm good. Yeah, let's do this.
Okay, so there's a lot of different topics, so I'm going to really test you today. So first one being, with Bashar al-Assad, he's now back in the Arab League. People have generally accepted him in the wider the international community. Why are relations being normalized with him?
So the reason why relations are being normalized is the situation Bashar al-Assad was in, where his people rose up against him, can very easily be the same situation for any of the other Arab rulers in the region. So if you look at Iran, if you look at Iraq, if you look at Lebanon, Algeria, Sudan, you've had, you know, very recently you've had uprisings in these countries. So what you find is, in order to take the steam out of the uprising in Syria, many surrounding countries joined in the struggle. They apparently on paper supported some of the different rebel groups. And what you find is one by one, all these rebel groups were forced to enter into negotiations with the regime. And this is important, Yusuf. You know, many people feel relations are being normalized now. Why? What you got to remember is all these countries, Jordan, Qatar, UAE, all the Arab League countries, all of them have been telling the rebel groups they've been backing that you need to go to Astana, you need to go to Riyadh, you need to go to Geneva, you need to go to these talks where you're going to be talking with the regime and you're going to come up with some sort of resolution. So in theory, this isn't anything new. The only difference was, for the last 10 years, it was quite evenly balanced. Would the rebels win? Would they overthrow the regime? Or would the regime survive? So naturally, all the Arab rulers didn't want to be on the wrong side. So they've waited it out. But when they waited it out, it's not like they were all fighting the regime. They were still aiding the regime by weakening the rebel groups. And I say weakening because none of them gave any of the rebel groups any weapon that would make a difference on the battlefield. So none of them gave them advanced weaponry, surface to air missiles, anything like that. And this is something the rebel groups still complain about today. So now, 10 years later, Bashar has survived by completely destroying his own country. And now he's being welcomed back. And I think it's just a matter of time before the international community welcomes him and they call him a reformer again. And, you know, we've heard this term many times, reformer. Bashar al-Assad was a reformer in 2010. He was being wined and dined in Buckingham Palace. John Kerry was very clearly visiting him. When the uprising started in Syria, the first thing Hillary Clinton said is, he's a reformer. We've got to give him a chance. So, you know, it's not like these terms are new. They've come out of nowhere. Really, Syria has become a bit of an experiment, which is, how do you deal with your people when they rise up? Because this is a challenge all the Arab rulers face, because none of them represent the people. All of them are allied to some sort of global power against their own people. So this is something that is likely to occur again. And, you know, we had the first round of the Arab Spring. It looks like we're probably due another one soon. So he's being welcomed back because he has now created a model which the other Arab country may have to utilize in order to stop an uprising of trying to overthrow them. So why are relations being normalized with Bashar al-Assad? The relations are being normalized because he has won. He has shown the Arab rulers how you defeat your masses if they're trying to change the status quo. So because of that, he's now being welcomed back.
Next question, Adnan. What does Erdogan's recent electoral victory mean for Turkey's future?
Okay, so 20 years later, 7 elections later, Erdogan has managed to form a majority in parliament, and he managed to win the presidential election, although it went to the second round. So very, very unique, because the elections took place in a very interesting context. It took place 3 months after the massive earthquake in the south of Turkey, where many people were unhappy with the absence of the government. It came in the context where a lot of European media were giving the opposition a lot of credit and coverage. So the Economist in the UK, for example, they congratulated the opposition for winning the election. They, unfortunately, now going to have to eat humble American pie. But you know, the European media really gave a lot of coverage to the opposition that they wanted Erdogan out. So despite all of this, Erdogan won. Regarding the future, Yusuf, although Erdogan won, I feel he can only lose now. The economy is going against him. His own party, there's no transition plan. The opposition is much more united. I mean, if you look at the presidential election result, I think it must have been quite painful reading for Erdogan. He got 52% of the vote. So 48% of people, nearly half, voted against him. So, you know, that's not really a sign of someone who has a large majority and is well ahead. What that shows you is he probably peaked a long time ago, and really this is the beginning of the end. Now, I'm not sure Erdogan sees it like that, because he seems to be operating like the end is very, very far away. So I think for Turkey's future, it's going to be quite tricky. You've got significant economic problems. Inflation is very high. Debt is really, really high. And the opposition is growing much more organized and much more confident. I think there will be instability going forward. For Erdogan, it's 2023, the 100-year anniversary of the Turkish Republic, and he's the leader. Next year will be the 100-year anniversary of the abolition of the Caliphate. So what Erdogan is showing is he is the modern-day Mustafa Kemal. He is Turkey. He's navigated Turkey from a 230 billion economy in 2002 to one that's now 800 billion. Turkey now is no backwater nation. It's involved in all the key issues of the world. Syria, Palestine, Libya, Armenia, Azerbaijan. So Turkey is a very important country. But, you know, any European leader, Western leader, would give an arm and a leg to be in power for 20 years. Erdogan has won successive elections, so that's quite unique. But I feel a lot of trends are going against Erdogan, so we'll have to wait and see how he navigates this.
If we move on to Pakistan, so Pakistan has been on the news a lot recent months with Imran Khan. What is the current status in Pakistan between the army and Imran Khan? What's going on between them?
So, yes, so it's been a few weeks now where things really escalated. Imran Khan was giving interviews where he was singling out the army head, Asim Munir. We saw the massive demonstrations where Imran Khan's party and their supporters attacked army headquarters. They tried to lay siege to army bases. In effect, they tried to do a coup, which ultimately failed. And there was a period where there was a bit of a vacuum in the country. Asim Munir had just become the general in November. He still hadn't proven himself. Imran Khan was getting much, much more vocal and much, much more confident. But then Asim Munir has hit back. And what he did is a couple of things. First thing they did was they arrested all the senior guys and anyone related to Imran Khan's party. Some of them were sent to prison on trumped-up charges to the middle of the desert. And effectively, what we've seen since then is one by one, they've all left Imran Khan's party. They've all said they're leaving, or some of them said they're leaving politics. So Imran Khan's party has gone from originally being Imran Khan only to where all people from other parties jumped ship and joined him. And now Imran Khan's party has gone back to what it always was, which is just Imran Khan. Imran Khan famously, he said a couple of weeks ago that you have arranged marriages, forced marriages. What we've got is forced divorces now, where the army's forcing Imran Khan's senior members to actually leave his party. So the latest really is the army is back on top. And remember, Imran Khan was the army's creation. And Imran Khan really is just shouting from the sidelines. So even if there's elections very soon, Imran Khan doesn't actually have many candidates he can put forward. So really what the army's done is they pulled the rug from beneath his feet. And I think Imran Khan's probably learned the hard way that, you know, if you jump into bed with the army, then these sort of things are going to come and haunt you at some point.
We've not talked about Afghanistan and the Taliban for a long time, actually. But recently there was tension that broke out between the Taliban and Iran. What's going on with this? What's the latest in Afghanistan?
So yeah, it's now over a year, probably come to 2 years now in August when the Taliban took over. And it's been quite difficult for them. They've been cut off from international finance. America's put sanctions on them. They've tried to talk to everybody, all the surrounding countries. So, you know, China's come to Afghanistan, Iran has come, Central Asian countries have come as well, Saudi has come. So they've been trying to really talk to everyone, but the situation is quite dire economically. Not necessarily because of Taliban policy, but also because the regime America propped up for 20 years completely messed the country up. And now what we've seen in the last couple of weeks, you've seen this tension with Iran, and a lot of this really centered over the Helmand River. which is a river that flows through Iran, Afghanistan, and even parts of Pakistan. And what it shows you, this region used to be one region, so that's why there was never a dispute. When the British then carved up the region, what they did was they created different countries and different borders. So what you found was the countries, Afghanistan and Iran, needed to have a treaty and they needed to collaborate. But time and time again, nationalism got in the way. So the last 20 years, the Ashraf Ghani, especially president of Afghanistan, he built loads of dams along the Helmand River. And that has an impact on the water that goes to Iran. So, you know, the south of Afghanistan, the south of Iran, the northwest of Pakistan, you know, they all are close together and it's largely desert. So there's very few water sources. That's why this particular water source is really, really important. So since Taliban came to power, there's been about 10 border clashes or attacks over this. And so that's really what's going on. This, you know, it's probably coming at the worst possible time for the Taliban. Taliban have so many issues to deal with. And now this is another one added to the list of problems that they're going to have to deal with.
Now, Ukraine, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, it's been going on for some time now. Where is the war up to? Where does Ukraine currently stand?
Okay, so end of February was the 1-year anniversary of the Ukraine war. And really, by October last year, things came to a bit of a standstill because the winter was starting and it's difficult to fight in Ukraine with the winter to supply your troops. So what we find by winter, two main things that had happened is firstly, Russia had lost half of the territory it occupied. And then secondly, Ukraine was actually making some inroads into the north and the south of Ukraine to get it back. Then things slowed down considerably with winter, and there was lots of talk of a counter-offensive by Ukraine. Russia had mobilized more troops. So, you know, come spring, come summer, you're going to see the return of clashes. So literally last week, Yusuf, Ukraine started its offensive. And what you see at the same time, Russia reportedly blew up a dam, which means that part of the invasion force won't be able to take that route from Ukraine, because can't move equipment against water that's going to be traveling along so many different areas. So really, there's no end in sight in the Ukraine war at the moment. What we do know is the European economies are struggling with energy. Russia has seen a big drop in its oil revenues, which is going to have an impact on the longevity of this war. But for the moment, there's no talk about talking. It's all about who can achieve more on the battlefield in order to negotiate from a position of strength. So, yeah, that's really where things are.
Adnan, we can't really talk about Ukraine without talking about the rebellion by Wagner a few weeks ago. I mean, we did do a podcast at the time, but what do we know now that we didn't know back then?
So, Yusuf, what took place for a weekend was a rebellion. It was a rebellion by really an oligarch. Yevgeny Prigozhin is an oligarch, made a lot of money like the other oligarchs did. However, his problem wasn't actually with Putin. His problem was with the defense chief, Shoigu, and the head of the army. And his problem is, which has become more clearer now, is the fact that he had tensions with both of these individuals. And a lot of this goes back to the fact that Wagner are trying to take credit for some of the battlefield victories. And this led to the defense head and the army chief cutting ammunition and supplies to Wagner forces. So as a result, this has caused many deaths. It's led to Wagner struggling on the battlefront. Now, this is something Prigozhin has been saying for a while. He was getting very critical. He took to social media. So what he really did was he responded. He led a rebellion. And his rebellion led him to take over the military base from the south of Russia, where the war in Ukraine is being launched from. However, when he took it over, he realized that there weren't any high-level officials there. The war in Ukraine is actually being run out of Moscow. So when he took over that military base, he realized there was no one of importance there. And that's when he started talking about a march to Moscow. However, what he didn't anticipate was the fact that senior officials and Putin came out against him. They said this was treason, this was a rebellion. And he thought as he marches towards Moscow, others would come out and support him. That actually didn't happen. And that's why we see the offer that was made by the Belarusian leader. He took that up in the end. Now, what a lot of people were surprised was with a couple of things. Firstly, the fact that Putin negotiated with him. He didn't take him out, but that's actually how he's generally dealt with the oligarchs. When Putin came to power, he dealt with the oligarchs by telling them, you need to get out of politics, you can keep the money you've made, but now you need to run your business as businesses rather than polluting the nation and things like that. And I think there were two oligarchs who refused to do that. And, you know, one fled and the other one, Berezovsky, he ended up in prison for nearly a decade. So this is quite normal. The other thing we also know is that Prigozhin is saying the war's not going well. On that front, he actually spoke the truth. So Putin's going to be careful here. You know, if he takes him out, what you're saying is if anybody criticizes the war, you're possibly going to get killed. Now, the fact that Putin had to mobilize additional troops, that shows the war wasn't going well. So on that front, Prigozhin actually spoke the truth. So what Putin's effectively done is he's removed Prigozhin from the head of Wagner. And now probably what will happen is a new leader will emerge from Wagner. Putin probably needs to purge Wagner forces to make sure that the only people in Wagner mercenary group are those individuals who want to continue with the war. So really, this lasted for about a weekend. The West were caught off guard. They didn't expect that this level of rebellion could occur at the highest level. And they were also surprised how quickly the rebellion ended as well. There wasn't like lots of bloodshed. There wasn't like a massive crackdown. What really happened was there was a rebellion, but the rebellion didn't really get any support from wider forces. So if this was going to be successful, Prigozhin needed the FSB to come out and support him. He needed more heavyweights in the Communist Party to support him. He needed the military really to come out further and actually support him. That didn't happen. So I think going forward, Yusuf, what we need to look out for is how much impact this has on the morale of Russia's army. The broader army is struggling in Ukraine, so this potentially could have impact on them. We need to keep an eye out on other senior officials within the Kremlin. Do they stick to Putin or do they believe this is the beginning of the end and they should jump ship as well? But the Western media gave it significant coverage. They were calling it a coup. It obviously hasn't turned out like that, but will it have an impact? This is something we're going to be watching at the Geopolitics.
Now, the next couple of questions, they're more about where you think a country will be in the future. First one is India. So India is progressing at a very fast rate. Do you think it can ever become a global power?
So India has the potential to become a power. It has the ingredients, but there are significant obstacles that will need to be overcome if India ever does become a power again. And these are many. Firstly, India is heavily divided internally. India is divided by Hinduism, by sect, by gods, by language, and then you've got significant minorities. But the biggest priority for central government is the different regions. And then the heads of these regions, their biggest issue is their particular region. So what you find when it comes to foreign policy, there's not that much direction. Most India is a continent size. So for most leaders in India, it's always their main priority has always been internally. It's never been about power projection or anything like that. The second problem they've really got is energy. India has a huge dependency on foreign energy. It doesn't really have much of its own energy. It's tried to use renewable technology. But India is heavily reliant upon energy from the Middle East, from oil, from places like Qatar, UAE, these sort of places. So that's, you know, if you don't have a regular supply, independent supply of energy, you're going to have a massive problem going forward. Then also, I would question you, so finally, does India actually have global ambition? I mean, India wants to be respected. India wants to be the dominant power in the region. I'm not sure they have global aspirations. I'm not sure they know what that even means if they did have. I think with India, it's about honor and respect. They want a powerful India. But India solving the two-state solution, India solving African issues, India solving climate change, apart from the fact that they won't want to get involved in this, they have no clue how to get involved, even if they wanted to. So, you know, really all these issues are going to act as obstacles unless they can be overcome. It seems the political parties in India are more interested in enriching themselves and, you know, playing different narratives to give themselves credibility. So that will make a leader or a party strong, but it's not really going to help them build a strong nation. We can expand and go into other countries. So, no, unfortunately, although India potentially can and it has the ingredients, I think the challenges and the obstacles are just too big for them to overcome them currently.
This next question, I think it's really a podcast in and of itself, is US power in decline?
So this is probably the most fashionable or the most discussed topic really at the moment. And obviously it has ramifications. America, the global power, is in decline. Then much of what America established in terms of the global liberal order, the institution, they would also be in question as well. And then who's going to replace it? What are they proposing? And obviously, if you look at this century, America was involved in two wars, which were a complete failure. America's economy imploded in 2008 with the global economic crisis. And now you've got polarization internally at home. You know, Donald Trump isn't an exception. Donald Trump is representative of at least half of America. What he says, what he calls for, and this is leading to massive divisions within the political class in America. You're seeing Trump looks as though he's going to run for elections again, and all the polls say he's going to win. However, he has various indictments against him, which is going through court. So really, America is not that shining beacon on the hill. American democracy is not an example for everyone. If anything, if we were to talk about America and not mention any names, you'd think we're talking about some banana republic in Africa or the Far East or South Asia. But we're talking about America. So when you put this all together, all of these are indicators of decline for people. Now, I will just say, Yusuf, is America abandoning its role in the world? Of course not. America is still engaging in the world. At the moment, America has dealt with the EU. The EU transatlantic relations were rock bottom when Trump left. Biden's managed to get it back on the right footing, and he's even got Europe to take economic pain against the war against Russia. So that shows you politically they dealt with the EU. America has now embroiled Russia in a war in Ukraine. So that allows America to completely focus on the one main challenge it's got, which is China. And it doesn't expect the European Union to get in the way or Russia, but they're busy with a bigger war on their own continent. So I think America's power has taken a hit. I think Russia and China are much more confident today because they saw America's military is not as capable as they made it out to be, as we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan. However, China or Russia or anyone else is not proposing a new world order. They're not proposing a new ideology for the world. And I think this is probably why America will be in decline for a long time, but it won't get replaced because no one else has an alternative at the moment. China and Russia would like to remove America from the number one spot. But then they would like to take the number one spot. They would like to be the head of the global liberal order, the global financial system. So, you know, there's no Cold War in the world today. This is not two ideological blocks battling out. This is a great power competition over national interests, not over ideologies and, you know, making your ideology supreme.
Adnan, can you explain how the concept of a vassal nation works?
Okay, so now that we're on this topic, we probably need to do a podcast on this, but this question seems to come up quite a lot. Even I saw on social media, this is quite a common question. But put simply, you know, a vassal nation is not something new. It's always existed in time. And a vassal nation is someone who's completely or nearly completely subordinate on another power. So their foreign policy is controlled by another power, and then that power even has influence and a say over some of the domestic policy. So example of this is Pakistan being a vassal for America, Egypt being a vassal for America, Belarus, Kazakhstan being vassals for Russia. That's what we're actually talking about. Now, why is this important from a geopolitical international relations perspective? It's important because global powers will use their vassals to achieve their strategic goals. So rather than the power doing all the heavy lifting, they will get their vassal nation to do some heavy lifting as well. So you're finding, for example, America has recruited everyone in its campaign against Russia in Ukraine. So all American allies have been forced in one way or another, although some of them are fighting back, that they're going to support the American position. Nobody wants to be seen to be supporting the Russian position. In fact, the only people openly sided with Russia were Venezuela, Syria, and Cuba. Not exactly the biggest bloc in the world. So a vassal nation works by its close relationship with another power. And its foreign policy is the foreign policy of that foreign nation. And the vassal becomes the tool in the hands of the foreign nation. Now, each vassal leader, vassal state, is different to another. The degree of control a foreign power can have will differ. It could be you have control over one person at the top. It could be you have a control over the whole state or the institution. So that's a vassal nation, and it's quite important because it's important to know which countries are vassals and who are their vassals for, because they are tools being used by the major power. And by understanding this and seeing what they're doing, we can then make sense of what's going on in the world, what's going on in the world of international politics.
On that topic of a vassal nation, how is it possible that independent nations, that they have a dispute with another nation's, well, someone else's vassal nation?
So I suspect the question of what he's asking here is, if a country is a vassal state, then surely the master will bail out the vassal if another power has an issue with them. So if you're a vassal nation, you're completely beholden to a foreign power. If another power disputes with you, then the assumption here is the power you're a vassal to will come and help you because you're their vassal. And there's a couple of things that we need to understand is, in theory, that is true. What we find in practice doesn't always work like that. So what you find, for example, is some vassal nation have leaders who are strong, they're quite confident, and they're able to take advantage of their boss who needs them. So you find, for example, Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan, he did this a lot of times. He got concessions for himself and his family because at that time, America needed him in power. There was actually literally no one else that could take over. We found, for example, when Qatar and Saudi fell out, there was a spat over trade and over Al Jazeera, I think it was. Some of the stuff I was saying about Saudi. You find there was a big spat between Saudi, who is, you know, close to the US, and then Qatar, who's close to Britain. There was a spat between them, which both countries then came to some pragmatic agreement in the end. So it's absolutely possible. And the theory is, if you're on the verge of being overthrown, then your power will come and help you, which is actually true. 9 times out of 10, that does happen. But due to global competition, it's natural that there's going to be a clash between different countries. It's natural that there will be disputes between vassal nations and other countries. And what tends to happen here is the vassal will run to his master, and the whole the master will bail him out. Some sort of negotiated settlement is usually agreed. So all the rulers in the Middle East that are still pro-British, America always haunts them. America always chases them down. America tries to give him concessions, so they leave British security guarantees and come over to America. So yeah, it's absolutely possible. You know, vassal nations having disputes with independence, it does happen. And this is just another aspect of the global system that we have.
The final question, I think that this is something that we can all benefit from. How do we acquire deep political thinking? Are there any particular books that you can recommend for us?
So I think we've got to differentiate here between political knowledge and political thinking. If you want knowledge of what happened, who said what they did, what the strategy, then books are good for that. Political thinking on its own isn't actually developed just from reading books. We read books, we want to understand issues that have happened, history, or understand a topic. On its own, that doesn't necessarily build political thinking. You know, political thinking is about the events that are going on in the world. What are the players up to? What are their strategies? And what's your strategy? If you were the ruler, if you were in a position of power, how would you navigate this? So for that, you need to pursue the news. You need to pursue the events. You need to pursue the main nations in the world. So Russia, America, China, Britain, France, Germany. These are the key powers in the world. Most of the things that happen in the world is due to the competition between these countries. That's probably a good starting point. Yeah, you need to be following the key nations. Yeah, then I would advise it's probably a good idea to read up about some of the recent history of these nations. But it'll give you an insight into the character of the nation, how its outlook towards the world developed, and, you know, what are they trying to do to actually achieve it. So I think, you know, that sort of stuff would actually help. But, you know, it's all about, you know, what is going on currently and what does that mean? Does it mean the decline of America? Does it mean the rise of China? And all of that has implications. So, you know, there's no shortcut to this, unfortunately. For you to learn critical thinking, you need to put in the hours, you need to pursue the news, you need to pursue the events, you need to try and make sense of them, you need to link them with the realities, you need to look at the potential outcomes. None of this is easy. This takes time, it takes effort. You may read stuff and it's not clear to you, or, you know, there's not enough detail. So yeah, by reading, you get the past. But I think it's important, critical thinking, we're observing what the major powers up to now. What are they doing? What meaning are they having? What does it mean? What are the implications? And that will probably be a good place to begin.
Thanks for your time today, Adnan. I hope Adnan's managed to answer all of your questions. If you have any more, definitely send them through. Now, some of these topics, you can probably find a lot more detail if you go onto our website on different issues. We would probably have a podcast. So I think I've done the one about power decline. US power decline is a good one to discuss. You can check these out on our website, www.thegeopolicy.com. Thank you for your time.